I agree very much with the thrust of Martin's last comments, and I actually I have a theory. When you look at how the administration has sort of failed to inject urgency into the Blair mission, into the Dayton mission, and into the General Fraser setup of how one monitors roadmap obligations, I think one can reach the conclusion that this is collectively just too hard, that it all belongs in the too hard to do file, that a judgment was made that going down that route was just too hard to do, that too many resources, too many people, too much time, too much effort, and the output, the success might not be there. It might not be any visible success, and it might still be where you are when you start. And so I almost get this sense as though the president has decided to insulate his relationship with the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the Palestinian Authority. And if only those two guys could reach an agreement amongst themselves, that is where the effort needs to be invested. And that seems to be what the strategy is to do whatever is possible to promote a relationship among these two leaders, completely divorced from the objective realities on the ground. It is, shall we say, a novel strategy. I very much agree with Martin's comment that it is unlikely to achieve the sort of result that the administration is hoping for, and may in fact lead us to a similar end at the end of this year as what happened at the end of the Clinton administration in terms of the handoff, and that I think would be quite regrettable. If I could just open by asking each of you a question. How would you, first to Martin, does it make a difference looking now at our presidential election campaign? Does it make a difference to the president who the candidates are? And how would you imagine the best sort of conversation that this president could have in terms of handing off a peace process to his successor? And to Harvey, you outlined four areas and focused on Arab-Israeli peace, where the president picked the maximum and is perhaps unlikely even to get the minimum. Is there another one of these four that the president could have chosen to invest his time and effort where he might have gotten closer to the maximum, or where he might indeed get closer to the maximum, and where his effort might be more usefully expended?
I didn't understand the first question.
Do the potential successors have in any way an impact on how the president approaches his last year? Gentlemen?
I think, in fact, that George Bush's heart is in the possibility of an agreement in Jerusalem, but his head is in the Persian Gulf. And the minimum benefit that a process gives him is that it makes it easier, or at least that's what the administration thinks, in rallying an anti-Iranian coalition. So from Bush's point of view, if history says that he failed to get an Israeli-Palestinian agreement, well, he's no better, no worse than all those who went before him. But if history says that he failed to arrest an Iranian nuclear program, or that he left Iraq in a hopeless shambles, to me, anybody with even rudimentary mental equipment will conclude that it's the latter that's far more significant in the long term than the former. And so Martin may be correct in sensing that the syndrome having taken over temporarily, when they got back to Washington and started to figure out what kind of resources would be necessary to throw into this, they are moving in the direction of keeping a process going, and they have a fair degree of confidence in that, simply because the other two parties to the process also have a stake in keeping the thing going. A lot of diplomats can be involved in this. In fact, the four or five, I count three, but that's because I have trouble counting as an old speechwriter beyond three. But you've talked about four or five different levels or six different levels. It's a full employment act for diplomats. And we know many of these diplomats. They're quite capable of taking up the time and the process. And so you at least have the makings of that. But where I think the administration is likely to invest its real muscle is going to be in the Iraqi, such as it has, is going to be in the Iraqi-Iranian thing. Because for the long term, that can have a far more significant consequence on the rest of the region and on Bush's historical reputation than yet another attempt to reach an Israeli-Palestinian agreement.
I agree with most of what Harvey just said, but I think you're too cynical. Part of the problem with the Bush administration's approach is it's throwing people at it. Actually, it's not diplomats, it's generals. Now, we've got three generals involved in it. I don't think any of them actually has a clear idea of what they're supposed to be doing. It's not a question of throwing people at it. It's really a question of paying attention and making the effort to move what is a very complicated process and very difficult process because of so many negative things that have already happened, of moving it forward. And in terms of Rob's question, this election cycle is unique in the sense that there's no incumbent, no vice president who's running for president, as was the case with Al Gore for Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton did make several calculations about, how this would affect Gore's chances. And he was very conscious of that. I don't think that Bush has the same concern. Obviously, he'd want a Republican to win, and that would be part of his legacy if a Democrat came in. I don't think he'd prefer that. But it's not clear to me that anything he does at this point will really make a difference to the prospects of either the Democratic or a Republican candidate. It's quite amazing the extent to which the Middle East has not become part of the debate, presidential debates. I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the level of violence is down in Iraq. If it springs up again, particularly if more Americans are killed, God forbid, then it could well become an issue. But as Harvey suggests, that's going to be far more about the Gulf, and what he does or doesn't do in the peace process is going to be much less important. So I don't see that's a critical factor. In terms of what I would like him to say to the new president, whether it be a Democratic or Republican president, is the following. I was wrong. It matters to, you need to pay attention to this process. It matters if you care about the security of Israel. It matters if you want to concert an alliance, a virtual alliance of Arabs and Israelis against Iran. And it matters to the war of ideas, which is so critical to winning the war on terrorism. And that's why you need to make it a priority, not your first priority, but a priority in your administration.
Thank you. We'll turn the floor over to questions. Marvin, Dennis, George, right over here, Greg, and then we'll do another round. Can you speak into the microphone, please?
I'd like to rephrase Rob's second question, and that is, let us say for a second that the working process has been established. There is such a thing. And in that handover conversation between President Bush and the new president, which, in your judgment, and I appreciate you'd be looking into the future here, which of the three candidates now running, two Democrats, one Republican, is more apt, best positioned psychologically, politically, in terms of background and interest, to pick up that working process and make something of it.
Dennis?
Martin, I very much agree with your assessment of the last year, and I would say that of the Clinton administration, I think that in our own way we failed from a statecraft model because we identified an objective that we didn't have the means to achieve. It didn't fit the circumstances. I think your assessment now of what the administration is doing is also right in terms of having an objective they can't achieve, but having created a structure that has at least the possibility to have a process. The question I would have for you, if the objective now is to turn over a process to the next administration, what has to be achieved between now and then to have a process that will be viable? Because as you know, simply having a process isn't going to be enough, and especially given the kinds of pressures that Abu Mazen is likely to become subjected to, what is it that has to happen between now and next January so that you'll have a process that actually is something that one could actually inherit and then work with?
George? It's on, isn't it? Put the light on. No, but you did before. Thank you.
Okay. I agree with you, Martin, about Syria. I think Syria is a very important thing that we should pursue very quickly. However, I don't think there can be an Israeli-Palestinian settlement with only Abbas. Gaza cannot be overlooked. And I think there was a chance before the Gaza liberation, if you want to call it, as they call it, because Hamas's popularity has really went down a lot in Gaza. So I think this is an opportunity for us and the Egyptians to work out an agreement between the whole Arab countries, between Abbas and Hamas, and just hope for the next election things will turn out differently. Israel needs, as much as the Palestinians, believe it or not, needs a settlement nowadays, unlike the last 40 years. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, and actually, kind of building on that question, campaigns use contrasts when they're basically contrasting often themselves with the current administration. And so in a sense, my question is about how what the Bush administration does now is affecting the campaign positions that candidates are taking and potentially therefore impacting at least the first period of the next administration. You know, this goes back for every campaign does this. Bush was embracing Netanyahu, and you go through each election and these contrasts are drawn. And two specific issues that I think we all are concerned about where this has really happened are Iran and Hamas. You know, I have seen among a lot of, let's say, Democrat-affiliated experts, often, and I know, Ambassador Indyk, you've confronted this issue, this sort of, we need to talk to Hamas and bring them into the process. So there's a Hamas issue, but also Iran. Now, the Bush administration has been criticized as being too hardline and unwilling to talk to Iran and Hamas. And so I'm wondering if that is going to set the stage for, if there's a Democrat victory, that there'll be a discussion about perhaps an overly open negotiation with those two entities.
Why don't we stop there, Martin?
Well, I'll let Harvey answer the first question. That was Marvin's question about which presidential candidate would be best suited to deal with this. Actually, the answer is Hillary Clinton, of course, but that's because I'm supporting Hillary. And for that reason, I don't want to get into handicapping any of the others. It's a fair question. It's just it's one that's very difficult to answer. In many ways, every president on going into the Oval Office is a tabula rasa, and his or her presidency, in effect, starts on day one. Of course, what he or she brings to the office will make a difference, but what happens there, I think, really forges the president. And my anecdote is an example of that from day one. So that's why I'm so concerned about the handoff. Because if there's a viable peace process, then whether it's McCain or Hillary or Obama, they will pick it up and they will move it forward. Maybe there'll be a little bit of a difference in the priority that they give to it. But it will, in effect, be a no-brainer, especially after the lessons learned from 7 years of neglecting it. So each will bring his or her own perspective on that. But if it's completely broken, then I think there will be a reluctance on the part of all three of them to really get engaged in it in a serious way. And because, you know, they're going to be looking at a whole lot of other problems, huge problems, both domestically and internationally. And so it's going to be very hard for those advisors who think it's really important to move on the peace process to make the case that that should be a priority. If the place is in flames, it'll be much more a question of how do you, you know, deal with the crisis management, get into a crisis management mode, tamp it down and focus elsewhere. And that would be, I think, a tragedy for Israel and for the region and our broader efforts to combat the message of Islamic extremism. What has to be achieved, Dennis's question? Well, I think it's if we go down, what we need to do is we need to start on the ground first. And that means those roadmap commitments do need to start to be implemented, both in terms of settlements and fighting terror and ending incitement. And we've now appointed a general to be in charge of that process. He really needs to get on the ground and start to work with the parties and start to make clear that he's going to issue public reports, not private reports, about what they're doing there, to give them some incentive to work on these things. We need to do what's necessary, and Tony Blair is the right person for this, but he's going to have to spend months there in interminable negotiations with the Israelis in particular about the conditions on the ground that will enable these economic projects to move ahead. The Arabs have to pony up. God knows they've got enough money. Saudi Arabia is getting $900 million a day, but they're not going to do it unless they see that the United States is directly involved, and we're going to have to guilt them into it. And we can only do that if we say, "Hey, we're doing our part. It's time for you to do yours." They're not doing their part at the moment, and that's no surprise to us. Seen this before. The negotiations themselves are important, in my view. But we saw the Israelis and Palestinians trying to negotiate some kind of declaration of principles dealing with final status issues before Annapolis. They negotiated for 45 days intensively. And in the end, what did they produce? A document that is so lacking in substance that they couldn't even say what the final status issues were. The Annapolis document says they'll negotiate on all the issues without naming one of them. And that just gives you an example of how hard it's going to be. But the objective, I think, should be to try to define with some greater granularity what the end game is going to look like for both sides, to try in that process to take away the fears of both sides about what two-state solution could mean for them. And if in the end it requires President Bush to put forward Bush parameters because he can't reach agreement with the parties, but in the end the administration, having engaged in this effort, can see enough common ground that he leaves office having said, you know, I've worked on this and here's what I think is a reasonable outcome. that could help the process for the next president as well. So I really think, and of course I've already said, we need to start an Israeli-Syrian negotiation. The irony in that is that both the Israeli prime minister and I think the Syrian president want to start a negotiation. And so it wouldn't be so difficult to do, and it would serve the rest of the process. The Hamas question doesn't lend itself to a sensible policy prescription. It doesn't. I mean, what are you going to do? Hamas, it's not as if Hamas wants to negotiate with Israel, George. It's not as if they want to end violence and give up on resistance. And it's not as if they want to hand back Gaza to the Palestinian Authority, having taken it by military putsch. And it's not as if Abu Mazen wants to sit down now and reconcile with them. And we are working with Abu Mazen to try to achieve an agreement here. On the other hand, if you exclude Hamas, if all you do is put Gaza into a pressure cooker, violence is going to engulf the whole process again. And so, you know, how do you work with this? It's very difficult. The logic of trying to show that the Palestinians, that the West Bank model is the model that Gazans should want to follow, is fine if you could actually move this process forward. But if you raise the expectation and then don't do anything, you're just going to help Hamas's argument. And sure enough, Hamas is going back up in popularity now. So I think that we have to be guided by Abu Mazen in this. I think the idea of putting the Palestinian Authority back in control of the passages makes sense as a tactical move to give the PA a toehold in Gaza again. I don't know why that hasn't been pursued. The Israelis announced last week that they were in favor of that idea as well. I agree that something has to be done to at least stabilize the situation in Gaza if this rest of the process is to move forward. I'm not one who advocates engaging with Hamas to do that. That is a tactical call which Abu Mazen needs to make, and he's not prepared to make it in circumstances where the balance of power is, and the balance of popularity is on Hamas' side. And so we have to do something to change the tilt of the table, if you like, in order to get somewhere there.
As far as the candidates are concerned, if you read what they've written in Foreign Affairs, some people are playing with the kumbaya effect, which is if we all sit around and praise peace, something magical will happen. And the others, frankly, don't say too much about this particular subject because they don't know what to do about it. So it's very hard at this stage of the game to draw any conclusions of what their methods may be. But I want to stress, like Martin, the importance of the turnover in this respect. What President Clinton said, in effect, to President Bush was this: don't invest your personal political capital in this thing. And he didn't. But if you're familiar with the run of Middle East politics, once they learn out there that the president really isn't interested, you're not going to get very far. They may devise ways to get the president interested, like a crisis, but they're looking for that symptom very early on, that sign that a president really wants to do something here, even if it's only to prevent a large problem from becoming a catastrophe or to keep a small problem small. They want to know that. The difficulty for a president who wants to get invested in this, because he, at the minimum, feels that he has to keep it from disrupting lots of other things, is the time and the effort that's going to be involved. Because once that president gets into it, all of a sudden, the deputy assistant secretary of state, they're not going to pay attention to him. The secretary of state, they're going to get tired very quickly. They want to breathe the same air as the president. And pretty soon you become president of the United States for the Arab-Israeli conflict. And nothing else. I think that our current Secretary of State understands that the minute she starts doing this in earnest, I mean, her days of liberty are numbered. if she doesn't get into this, when she gets into this within the next 90 days, which she will have to if anything is going to come of it, she won't be able to do anything else for the rest of the term. And that's where you get into this practical situation on the ground and where vertigo takes place. You know, Blair is a superstar. He gets there, they say all the right things, he goes to all the places, and they sit down to negotiate. You're either in an overheated room or an underheated room. The beverages are awful. There is no whiskey. And you're negotiating over things that would bore a county clerk. So for a superstar like Blair, this is a pretty bad business. And you really don't want to have anything to do with it. So you have this vesting problem at the outset. I'll give you an example. Probably many of you are not familiar with it. In the transition from Carter to Reagan, there was, at that point, a kind of a process going on, which was the negotiation over Palestinian autonomy. And it was there. It was alive. People were meeting, etc. But there was another issue, and that was the sale of the AWACS planes to Saudi Arabia. The incoming Reagan administration said to the Carter administration, you don't announce it, we'll announce it. Because the incoming administration wanted to show the president was really interested in this. But that meant that Reagan coming in had no vested interest at all in the autonomy negotiations, or for that matter, Camp David. And when in the fullness of time he got into a big battle with the Congress over AWACS, after he won AWACS and Sadat was murdered, a lot of people made a run at him to dispense with the Camp David agreements altogether in favor of King Fahd's ideas, which incidentally bear more than a passing resemblance to what Abdallah launched and the so-called Arab League idea. And it was only a manful effort at the State Department that got him turned around on that to put a force in Sinai. And without that force, you wouldn't have a peace treaty today. So there, you didn't have a president really vested in any kind of a process, and almost by accident, it nearly bounced the business away. That's very significant. I'll give another one. I don't know if Dennis is still here, but I think you could probably testify to this. When the transition occurred between Reagan and George H.W. Bush, George H.W. Bush and the people around him thought that a negotiating process with the Shamir government was a waste of time. They weren't interested in it. Bush didn't think anything would come of it. It was Baker who had to work that all the way through, and even then it probably would not have amounted to much, except that the war over Kuwait changed things around. Then President George H.W. Bush got vested in the peace process, where before he was not. So you have this very significant notion of how one chief executive says to another, should you be personally interested in this? There are a couple of ways to get interested in it, and you have to be interested in it, even if it's only to protect yourself against being bitten in the rear end by it, not at a time and place of your own choosing. So I think that in this next handover, that's going to be a highly significant business. And Martin is right. If it turns out to be another one, don't get yourself vested, well, then it's going to bite us.
There are a lot of variables in all of these transitions. There's at least one we should put on the table to remind us, and that is, of course, Israeli domestic politics. I mean, whatever conversation, for example, Martin, that Clinton had with George W. Bush in January, the conversation that you had with the president in April would have been very different if Arik Sharon hadn't beaten Ehud Barak in February. And so, too, when we look at next year, with the prospect of an Israeli election probably by certainly in the first quarter of 2009, we have a repeat of this, of whatever conversation the incoming and the outgoing president will have in January. At least as important to whether they carry the torch, whatever torch is being carried, will be dependent on who wins that Israeli election. So we have to keep at least this other variable in mind. Other questions? Yes. And yes. Into the mic, please. If you can identify yourself, please.
My name is Jehan Harney. I'm with the Visual News Corp, a new web-based news agency. And my question is regarding Iran. What is the best way to influence policies of Iran? Which is a better approach, engagement or sanctions? This is a question for one or both of the speakers.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much. Murat Karagöz with the Turkish Embassy. My question will be to Ambassador Indik, perhaps. And while he referred at the end of his presentation about the strategic context and the Israeli-Syrian negotiations, so I would like to ask more specifically to him, for instance, if he sees that there is really a genuine will in the both governments of Israel and Syria. Perhaps he may address also if there is a general will in the U.S. administration. And he could perhaps also address about the what could be the benefit of such a peace deal in the wider region. You may say Lebanon, and he may address also perhaps other countries. Thank you.
Yes, Dan in the back center.
Thanks, Dan Raviv of CBS. Martin, I'm thinking especially of something you said, that it could be helpful if President Bush formulates what would be good ideas and passes them on to his successor. But at the end of Bill Clinton's administration, it seemed like it was true, wasn't it? Mr. Clinton presented a piece of paper and said, once I leave office, forget about it. This doesn't even exist, like a tape in Mission Impossible. What was the intention, and might that be the way to go?
And then lastly, yes, here, on the left.
Ambassador Indik, Stuart Sloan. I would like to know how you can reconcile your statement, which sort of has become a mantra, 7 years of neglect, with your later statement that how difficult it would be, given the facts on the ground, or I think you put it, feet in the fire, to achieve anything. And perhaps I should put it another way. What do you think President Bush should have done, and when should he have done it?
Sure. But on that one, we only have 7 minutes, so that's a whole other lecture. But Martin?
A year.
At the end of the year, exactly.
Now, a minute a year.
Oh, a minute a year.
7 minutes for 7 years. Well, they're all very big questions, and since we only have a very short time, I'll have to go very quickly. I think that we need, in the Iranian case, we've got a real confusion about terms: engagement, sanctions, containment, negotiation. I would just make the argument that negotiation with the Iranians is not inconsistent with a policy of containment and sanctions, or a policy of engagement. That the negotiations are a tactical issue, and that we should have negotiations even if we're pursuing a policy of containment of Iran. That's the policy that I think we need to pursue here. More importantly, I do think that negotiations devoid of any effort to orchestrate the strategic context that I referred to in my opening remarks will necessarily fail. And what we have to do is to pay attention to the effort to make it clear to Iran that if its ambitions are dominance of the region, we're not going to accept that and it cannot achieve that. And by the way, working the Arab-Israeli peace process is an important way to start to put the Iranians on the defensive in the broader Middle East, which may help to make them more interested in negotiations. The most important thing that would make them interested in negotiations is oil declining to $50 a barrel, but I suspect we won't be able to achieve that. The question of the Syrians, again, this is a subject of a whole presentation on its own. I would just say that, as I said before, it seems to me clear that Prime Minister Olmert is interested in beginning a Syrian negotiation, not because he wants to achieve an Israeli-Syrian peace at this point, but because he sees the advantage to Israel of having negotiations proceeding on two tracks simultaneously, and he'll see which one holds out the most promise and then pursue that one.
are the Syrians genuine about? I think what the Syrians are genuine about is that they want a process, because that will help get them out of the corner, and they imagine, I think, that it will help them advance their objectives when it comes to Lebanon as well. But I think there's a way of constructing the process, in particular by using the beginning of an Israeli-Syrian negotiation to begin an Israeli-Lebanese negotiation, which would focus on Sheba Farms and steal Hezbollah's thunder. There's a way of using the negotiations to help to alleviate the pressure on the Lebanese government that exists at the moment, and as well to alleviate the pressure on Abu Mazen from Hamas and Palestine Islamic Jihad. The difference between Clinton parameters and what I was suggesting is Bush parameters, Dan, is that Clinton parameters were very much part of a process that had been going on for years and was now culminating in an attempt to reach an agreement. I'm suggesting that the attempt to reach an agreement this year is likely to be a mistake. But the effort to try to define what the Palestinian state would look like is worthwhile. And if you can't reach agreement on that, then Bush should do the opposite of what you noted Clinton did, and not say that this will be off the table if you don't accept it. I'm not even suggesting he would do this insisting that both sides accept it. He would rather do it as his conclusion as to what makes sense, so that laid out there are certain principles that the next administration can pick up and try to get an agreement over, but would help to provide that kind of horizon, political horizon, that the Secretary of State originally talked about, which made sense as the purpose of a negotiation. Finally, what should Bush have done? Look, I take this very personally because I was ambassador in Israel at the time. And there were two sets of recommendations that were generated as a flow-on from what the Clinton administration had been doing. The first was the Mitchell Report with its recommendations. The second was the Tenet ceasefire. And they each had an articulated set of steps that if President Bush had taken those seriously and focused on getting both sides to implement them, because people don't really realize this, but both sides had accepted them. Now you can say, well, it didn't matter. In Arafat's case, he would have accepted anything and not implemented. But Sharon accepted them, and he didn't argue about them. He accepted them. Sharon even offered, through me, President Bush, a settlements freeze, a full settlements freeze, conditioned on Arafat stopping the violence. When the Dolphinarium discotheque bombing, which was the first suicide bombing that took place, don't remember now, I think it was May of 2001, June 2001, Sharon sent his foreign minister, his defense minister, to me on a Saturday to say, we will not respond to this if the president comes in and gets Arafat to stop the violence. He was inviting the president to engage. And the attitude of the president was, I'm not going to go near these things. And as a consequence, the violence raged, the suicide bombings took over, and eventually, but only eventually and reluctantly, after 15 months in office, Sharon sent the army into the West Bank to take back control of the West Bank. Up to that time, I believe he was waiting for Bush to come in and make a serious effort to get Arafat to stop the violence. And that's what needed to be done. God, when the president came into office, the Intifada had been going on for only 3 months. And there were no suicide bombings at that point. And we had devoted 8 years to build a framework of peace, an infrastructure of peace. You know, there are lots of things you can say about it, criticize it or so on, but there was an edifice there that he could have picked up on. And instead, it was burnt to the ground. And now, when he finally comes around to wanting to do something, the ability to do something is highly constrained by the fact that everything has been destroyed.
Harvey, a final word?
Yeah, I think that I agree with much of what you said, except to the last point there, which is that after 9/11, the administration did make an effort, and that was in the endorsement of the two-state solution, including a Palestinian state. However, and I think this bears marking a little bit to your argument, that speech was made by the Secretary of State, and while the President associated himself with it, the real prestige on the line was that of Colin Powell. And when Zinni, General Zinni, was sent in to try to move this thing, then came the Iranian arms boat, arms boat business, and that reinforced Bush's conclusion that he should have nothing to do with Arafat, and then it was all over. I mean, following that particular one, there wasn't any alternative to moving. So you have an administration where when it was lucky, wasn't skillful, and when it was skillful, wasn't lucky. And that's an unfortunate deal. But I think just to end on a final word here, what's handed over here has to be seen in the larger context. I often think that in the Middle East, they don't think that Americans are very bright. And that what has happened here, particularly in the Bush administration, we're like a brontosaurus. And Osama drove a spike into our tails. About 6 months later, there's a mild disturbance in the brain, and the tail starts to swing. Well, God help you, friend or foe, if you're in the direction, you're in the line of that tail. And so they wait us out. They really do wait us out. And a lot of what you see going on now, I think, is part of that, including in the Iranian case. They'll modify their position a little bit because they think that Bush is crazier than most Americans, although all Americans are crazy, and therefore you really have to wait it out. So you're fighting here not only a battle of what you hand over, but an impression that you're dealing with a very confused government, and that more often than not, if they do something you don't like, just hold on, wait it out, and you'll be in a stronger position when they change their minds to do something else.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Martin Indyk and Harvey Sickerman.